Well, Friday and Saturday, we hit our Gutenberg Winter Institute 2006. And the topic of the institute was Christianity Confronts the Media. And the way that we got at that topic was by having the attendees read Plato's dialogue called Phaedrus, where Socrates and a young man, Phaedrus, discuss the difference between rhetoric and dialectic, which maybe in our language we could translate into the difference between manipulation and persuasion when it comes to communication. We also read from Jacques Ellul's book, Propaganda. Jacques Ellul is a French theologian, philosopher, sociologist, died in 1996, but wrote prolifically on the sociological issues, theological issues. And so we read that book too, and discussed readings from both Phaedrus and Propaganda. We also got at the subject by looking at Genesis chapter 3 and the conversation between the serpent and Eve. In addition, we looked at 1 Corinthians 1, verses 17 through the end of the chapter. And then there were some lectures just trying to tie in the ideas from all of the readings, whether from Plato or Ellul or from the biblical passages, as we sought to come to a better understanding of what the media is all about in our own society, and how we as Christians should view the media and understand the way that information is conveyed to us through the various media in our own society. So what I'm going to do this morning is ask each of these gentlemen certain questions. Dave Crabtree, as I said, who is the president of Gutenberg College, taught us from Genesis chapter 3. And so I'd like to ask him a few questions about that passage. And then Ron Julian taught from 1 Corinthians 1, and so we'll probe him a little bit on exactly what that passage had to say to us. And then we'll let Jack Crabtree, another tutor there at Gutenberg, be the caboose, and we'll see what he has to say about the ramifications of these passages and just the whole subject of propaganda media in our own culture and as it relates to us as Christians and to the church. So let me begin then with Dave here in Genesis chapter 3. And if you're familiar with that story, it is typically called the fall, after God has created the cosmos, as we learn in chapter 1. And then in chapter 2, he's created both Adam and Eve and instructed Adam and Eve to not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil there in the Garden of Eden. And so then in chapter 3, we find in the first verse that now the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Indeed, has God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden?" And Dave, on Friday, you mentioned that there's an ambiguity here with the word that gets translated in the New American Standard, any, that is, you shall not eat from any tree of the Garden of Eden. What do you think the serpent is saying, and therefore, what do you think he's trying to do with this question?
Well, the word that's translated, sometimes it's translated any, sometimes it's translated every. Both are possible in the Hebrew, and so it's ambiguous. But in either case, what the serpent is doing is saying, is it true that God has placed limitations on you? But this is not, it's not an idle question. It's not an innocent question. The serpent's kind of sidling up to her and saying, is it really true that God has placed limitations on you? Is it true that God has not said that you may not eat from any tree of the garden? Then that would be prohibiting all the trees. But is not from every tree of the garden? Are there some that are placed off limits? But either way, it's stressing the limitation. So it's kind of like saying, is it true that the cup is half empty? It's focusing on what God has said that they can't do. It's on the limitations. And I think that's a major part of his strategy.
Okay. We look then at the woman's response, and she says in verse 2, from the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat, but from the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat from it or touch it, or you will die. I notice that, Dave, in this, in her response, that she leaves out a key word that God had used when he first made the commandment to Adam and Eve, or really Adam in this case, in verse 15 of chapter 2, I'm sorry, verse 16, where he said, from any tree of the garden you may eat freely. Well, what do you see her doing by leaving out that word there in this, in her response?
Well, it looks like a rather innocent omission on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's fairly significant that God had stressed all of the freedom that he was granting to them. And in her response, she has minimized that. God had said, from any tree of the garden of you may eat freely. So two words that stressed his generosity, and she omitted both of those words in her recantation of what God had said. So in her mind, I think that indicates that in her mind, she has downplayed God's generosity.
Is there anything else in those, in her response that you find, sort of striking in comparison maybe to the way that God first addressed this commandment to her?
In essence, she captures all of, she essentially captures what God had said originally, but she makes a few changes, and I think all of those are significant of the way that she's looking at things, and all need to be taken into account. And that's my, I would just point out, my observation on historical, in Hebrew narrative in the Old Testament, is every word counts. And if you have God saying X, and then you have someone else giving their version of it, every change is worthy of consideration. Another change that she makes is she says, but from the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden. So she indicates what tree it is by its geographical location. God had said, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. He had given it a name. That's how he had indicated which tree they were supposed to stay away from. She indicated it by geography. And I think that that's indicative of the fact that she hasn't really thought about the significance of this tree. It's just that tree. But God had given it a name, and it was a name, I think, that was calculated to cause them to reflect on what's going on here. What is the significance of this tree? Why would God have placed it here in the first place? Another change that she makes is, she says, you shall not eat from it or touch it. She is adding the word touch. God had not said that. God said, you shall not eat. I've gone back and forth over the years as to the significance of this. Is she just adding something that is in keeping with the spirit of what God had said? Or is this an addition that is not in the spirit of what God had said? And this weekend, I'm inclined to think that it is an addition that is not in the spirit. That I think what she's done here is she has added to the commandment with, in a sense, in the best of intentions, she wants to make sure that she doesn't violate the command. However, by increasing the prohibitions, once again, she's minimizing the generosity of God. That God really, I think, was allowing them to touch it, but they were not to eat. Then the other difference is, she said, lest you die. God had said, for in the day that you eat from it, you shall surely die. God had stressed the immediacy of the punishment and the certainty of the punishment, and she had rounded that off. I think in every case here, you see it's not that she is misrepresenting what God said grossly, but she has just kind of taken the edges off of it. It doesn't have the sharpness that it had when God presented it. And I think that indicates they hadn't really thought about the nature of this commandment that God had given them, and they haven't thought about the nature of this God who is doing this, and they've lost track of his generosity and the seriousness with which his commandments are to be taken.
How about the serpent's response to her then in verse 4? You surely will not die. What is he alluding to there?
Interesting, because he starts out with just a question. And it's just like, I'm just curious. Give me an answer to this question. Now, after she has responded, now he's making a direct contradiction to God. He's saying, what God said, that won't happen. You will not die. God had said, you will surely die. And he's saying, oh, it isn't going to happen. And I think what he's tapping into is saying, you realize you are that for which the world was created. Mankind is the pinnacle of the creative activity. God's not just going to kill you for something so trivial as eating fruit from this tree. That's not going to happen. They knew they were made in the image of God, and I think he's tapping into that. You are significant. God isn't going to wipe you out for some little indiscretion.
Can you maybe just summarize how this passage then relates to the issue of propaganda in the media, as we discussed at the Winter Institute?
Well, what's interesting here is the serpent is being very gentle. All the serpent is doing is suggesting ideas to her, but they're ideas that she is prone to be receptive to. She's sowing the seeds of discontent, and she is prone to being discontented. He's playing into her, I'll call it arrogance. I mean, it's like all human beings. We know we are made in the image of God, but we would like to be more than that. We would like to be God. And he's tapping into that. So he's just kind of leading her down the garden path. He's just kind of leading her along, but she is very receptive to it. This is a direction that she wants to go. And as Alul says, we are susceptible to propaganda because we want it.
Thank you. We'll switch gears here then. If you want to turn to 1 Corinthians 1. And Ron covered all of verses 17 through 31. We probably won't have time to do all of that. But let me read to you at least verses 17 and 18 of 1 Corinthians 1, where Paul writes, "For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in cleverness of speech, so that the cross of Christ would not be made void. For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God." Ron, you mentioned something about the phrase here that gets translated cleverness of speech in the New American Standard. I think in the King James Version, it's translated wisdom of words. What is going on there?
Well, as it happens, I think the King James has made a better choice there to translate it wisdom, because this is the word that we would typically translate as wisdom. And if you look at this section of 1 Corinthians, the theme of wisdom is very strong. Both the idea of the wisdom of the gospel, the wisdom of God, but also in a negative sense, the wisdom of the world. And Paul is using this here because, as strange as it might seem, there is a party of people in Corinthians, in Corinth, who don't really think much of Paul. They are even challenging whether he's an apostle or not. And in particular, they have charged him with not speaking with what they would call wisdom. So that's why he's opening up and saying, Jesus didn't send me to speak with the kind of wisdom that you think I ought to speak with.
You also mentioned Apollos and that he was important to understanding the context here as someone who also had contact with the Corinthians. How does Apollos fit into this picture then?
I think he's very important in this section. One of the things we really need to be careful of when reading a letter like this is that we want to pay attention to the flow of thought and what the issue is that Paul is addressing. And if you notice, in the first four chapters of 1 Corinthians, Paul is talking about divisions among them, and he keeps coming back to Apollos. It seems that some have decided that they like Apollos better than Paul. And what's interesting is that when we read in Acts about Apollos as a new believer who was very eloquent and in particular a great debater, he would take on the Jews and demonstrate that Jesus was the Christ from the Old Testament. That's the kind of thing that would be very impressive to some in Greek culture, that this is the kind of guy who can wipe out the opposition. That's what we're talking about. You know, that's impressive speech. And so we know at the same time, maybe I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, but in comparison, we know that the Corinthians didn't think much of Paul's speech. And in 2 Corinthians, he talks about how they charged him with being unimpressive and contemptible in his speech and so on. So Apollos is very central in this issue because people are saying, why can't you be more like him?
You alluded to 2 Corinthians, and there was a verse there in chapter 11, verse 6, where Paul himself even admits, but even if I am unskilled in speech, yet I am not so in knowledge. In fact, in every way we have made this evident to you in all things. So are you saying then that the Apostle Paul would have passed his systematic theology class but not his homiletics class? Is that the...
Yeah, maybe so. Certainly, if any of the Corinthians were judging it, that's the way they would have assessed it. The problem is, and this is at the heart of the problem, is they were more interested in the homiletics than they were in the theology. I mean, the striking thing about the situation is that, I mean, if you can imagine us as believers, if I could offer you, instead of listening to me, that you could listen to the Apostle Paul, I'll bet every one of you would take the deal. But here they are, they're looking at Apollos, they're looking at Paul, and they're saying, oh, Paul, this is not worth paying attention to. The problem is, how do you come to the place where you're so intent on the impressiveness of the speech that you ignore the true wisdom and profound understanding that someone like Paul has? And that's his concern in the situation.
Ron, also yesterday you made reference to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And let me just read three verses from it, verses 1 through 3, where Paul writes here, therefore, since we have this ministry, as we received mercy, we do not lose heart. But we have renounced the things hidden because of shame, not walking in craftiness or adulterating the word of God, but by the manifestation of truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. I was intrigued by the fact that he uses this phrase in verse 1. Since we have this ministry, as we've received mercy, we do not lose heart. Why does he even mention that? And how does the rest of what he says here, at least in verses 2 through 3, contribute to the point he's trying to make there, having said that?
Right. I would answer at this point, when he talks about losing heart, he's confronting the issue that all of us confront when we're talking about communicating concerning the gospel, is we would like it to be effective. I would like every time I speak to anyone about the gospel that they're blown away with how great the gospel is, and I wouldn't mind if they were blown away with how great I am in the process. But what Paul is saying is, in that whole section, he keeps mentioning that basically there are those who are being saved, who whom God has opened their eyes, and they're going to respond to the truth that I proclaim. And there are those who are perishing, and they just think it's foolishness. He talks about the gospel being veiled to people there. But he doesn't lose heart, because he knows that his job is to just accurately proclaim the gospel. He's not going to sell it. He's not going to distort it. He's not going to be ashamed of it and try to pretend that it's something else. Because you can get more followers. If you play down the difficult parts of the gospel, you will find more people who are interested. But what he's saying is, no, I'm going to be honest about this and straightforward. I'm not going to be crafty in the way I do this. And those who are prepared to respond to it will. And there's nothing I can do about the ones who are not prepared.
And then jumping back to 1 Corinthians 1, if you're following along with me here in your Bibles, there's a somewhat enigmatic statement that Paul makes in verse 25 of 1 Corinthians 1. Maybe I should read starting in verse 22. For indeed, Jews ask for wisdom. I'm sorry, the opposite. For indeed, Jews ask for signs, and Greeks search for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Can you help me understand that last verse there a little bit better?
Right. I think the key for us, Paul is not trying to say something like God is really foolish or anything like that. He's speaking to the perspective that the people that are accusing him would have, that the message of the gospel is not wisdom. The world around us isn't looking at it and seeing it as wisdom, and the message is not powerful in the sense that look at all of the people who are being bowled over by it. But Paul's saying God is quite content to save people through a message that the world thinks is foolishness. So what they call foolishness is in fact wiser than anything that they have to offer. And what they call weak is in fact so powerful that ultimately it is going to transform all of creation. So.
Good. Thank you, Ron. Pass that over to Jack. Jack Crabtree here. Then, Jack, got a few questions for you. If you wouldn't mind starting off for us, how would you define the word propaganda as we've explored that concept and from all the readings that we've done and discussions that we've had?
Okay. Yeah, Lowell in his book gives us a definition of propaganda, but I don't think that would be very helpful. I didn't understand it. What happens is when a picture of what he's talking about emerges as you read through the book, and so I'll give you my take on the picture that emerged for me. What struck me is it seems that propaganda is driven by two aspects of a kind of human arrogance. One is that I know what the world needs in order for it to be fixed, and the second one is I know what I need to do to get people to act in such a way that that will fix the world. Out of that, so the underlying assumption there is that there is some technique that I could use to basically play you and get you to act in keeping with whatever my purposes and goals are. Propaganda can happen in a centralized form, like in Hitler Germany or Stalin Russia or Chairman Mao in China, or it can happen in a rather spontaneous and not centrally controlled way like it does here in America. But for Alul, it's an absolutely universal, ubiquitous phenomenon in the modern world, at least in modern technological society. And it's the propagandist, let's look at America, the propagandist is somebody who looks out at the world and says, you know, we really need some changes here. People need to buy more, or people need to vote more, or people need to believe in Jesus, or whatever it is. We decide that there's this thing that they need to do in order to fix what's wrong with our culture, and they are a class of people or an individual who decides that they think they can do something about it. And so they take it upon themselves to find the way, find a means to move us to action according to their understanding of the desired action, and that whatever means they use then becomes propaganda.
Could you summarize what you see as a situation regarding the media in our own society, and what a term, the phrase that you used the other day, public discourse, and the condition of public discourse here in our country today?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest tragedies in our culture is that public discourse has completely disappeared. If what we mean by public discourse is to join together in public to seek to better understand what's true, to better understand reality. Instead, we've picked sides, and our goal in all of our public discourse these days is to gain points for my side and ultimately victory for my side. I would faint if I ever heard one politician say to another politician, "That's a good point." I mean, it is just unthinkable in the present situation, because we are always wanting to undermine the other side, undermine the other politician, undermine the other ideology, because victory is the issue here, not truth.
How about the Christian sector of society? Do you think that the Christian community is doing a good job or a bad job of steering away from propaganda? Why would you, the way you are?
I think we are doing a horrible job. We are very much products of our culture, and I include myself in that. This whole weekend, the reading and having to think about this material was really a serious rebuke to me, because I realize how many conversations I've been in with people where my whole mindset is, what do we need to do to get the response that we need to get? My intentions are wonderful. I want people to come to love God and love their neighbor as themselves. I want them to believe in Jesus. I want them to embrace the hope of the gospel. Nothing wrong with those as goals. That's perfectly appropriate. But my mindset is the modern mindset. And the mindset is that if I just find the right technique, the right way to speak, the right way to present the material or something like that, I can actually create a response in them of the right sort. And I know better than that. I mean, I've read my Bible. I know that's not how it works. That passage that Paul's talking about, if the gospel is veiled, it's veiled to those who are perishing. That our response to embrace the hope of the gospel is a supernatural miracle. Not a single one of us would believe it if God didn't reach into my heart and flip the switch. But all over the place, we in the Christian culture have the arrogance to assume that we can reach into their hearts and find that switch if we just have the right technique, the right message, the right approach, the right set of programs or something. And so because all too often we have that sort of arrogance, unfortunately, it colors everything we do in Christian culture, I think.
Jack, you also made this statement yesterday, I believe. Well, you asked the question with regard to Bible teachers, and as we're studying in our 9 o'clock Tuesday morning Bible study, little promo here, through the book of James, and in James chapter 3, James addresses those who want to be teachers. And I've been encouraging our entire Bible study that we're all teachers, because any time that we interact as a Christian, we interact with another individual, whether it's just through our actions or it's through our words. We're teaching something about God. We're reflecting our understanding of who God is. So this applies then to all of us as just Christians, wherever we might be. In our relationships with other people, you ask the question, do I want to be effective or do I want to be faithful to the truth? What did you mean by that question then?
Well, that's where I was most rebuked in reading this, that passage you read out of one of the Corinthian letters, about Paul says, I do not despair. It's very easy when you're a Bible teacher, if you're trying to faithfully represent the gospel, to get discouraged. Because the fact of the matter is, as Jesus told us, the way to eternal life is exceedingly narrow and few will go that way. The road to destruction is broad. Many are going to pass that way. well, it just seems like it should be otherwise. And so there's this tremendous pressure on anybody as a Bible teacher to want to reach more, to have the extent of the impact of the proclamation of the gospel be extensive. And I just find myself always thinking in terms of what's the scope of people's response, how extensive is the population of people who are responding to it, rather than focusing on being a good servant of Jesus who simply proclaims the truth that he told me to proclaim and allow the effect of that to be in God's hands, not in my hands. And the temptation to want to take that back into your own hands is just absolutely incredible, I think. But that's a choice that we have to make, because if we choose to be effective, then we will inevitably become propagandists and not Bible teachers. So the only way to protect ourselves from becoming propagandists for Jesus is to decide it's all right with me to simply be a faithful servant of Jesus, proclaim the message that he has shown us to be true, and allow the results of that to be left up to him.
As I was listening to all of you this last couple days, then it occurred to me that maybe a way to define the word manipulation is trying to get someone, and this is as a Christian certainly, and who's interested in other people becoming Christians and responding to God, that manipulation is trying to get people to act against their nature. Would that be right? And
yeah, I would actually look at it a little bit differently. What I would prefer to look at it is to act outwardly without it having it be an inward reality. That is, that the act of faith is a self-defining act. I'm making a choice that I'm going to define my very existence as being a servant of Jesus. But you can get people to talk like Christians, to think like Christians, to act like Christians, to go where Christians go, to drink what Christians drink, to smoke what Christians smoke, you know, whatever. You can get them to conform outwardly as Christians without them ever having engaged in that self-defining act of wanting with the desires of their heart to be a servant of Jesus. And the propagandist can get the outward conformity. He can successfully do that. But no propagandist can bring about the authentic reality of a heart that has chosen freely to define himself as a disciple of Jesus.
So you're saying then, in reality, only God is the one who can make us Christians?
Okay. I am.
Just wanted to be clear on that. That's all. Yeah. Dave, I heard, if you don't mind, Jack, one more question for you. I heard that you used a particular analogy in one of your discussions that had to do with something with a meal that would be helpful maybe for all of us to end with, keep in mind, with regard to this issue of being, all of us being teachers and what we should feel our responsibility is in terms of proclaiming the truth. Would you mind going through that analogy?
Well, I likened teaching, and in particular teaching the gospel, to setting the table and putting the food out on the table. And if you are a great cook, you can put a great meal out on the table. If you aren't a great cook, it may not be as good, it may not be as well prepared, but it's the best that you can do. Because in laying the table, you're just being a servant to those people who have come to eat. But it is not my job to get them to eat. That's a choice that they have to make. I'm just laying the table out. I'm doing the best that I can. I'm being a servant to those people. But they're the ones that have to eat. And if I think that my job is to get them to eat, I've overstepped my bounds. I'm not respecting the people that I have invited to the meal.
Well, thank all three of you for being with us this weekend and for helping us to better understand the scriptures and our jobs then as Christians.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Near the end of Paul's letter to the Colossians, he writes to them, devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving, praying at the same time for us as well, that God will open up to us a door for the Word, so that we may speak forth the mystery of Christ, for which I also have been imprisoned, that I may make it clear in the way I ought to speak. Conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. While it is true that only God can flip the switch inside a human being to change that person from a rebel against God to someone who now has the desire to embrace the truth, it is also true that each one of us should work on how we articulate the gospel to each and every individual with whom we come in contact, so that we can make it as clear as possible. That is part of our responsibility. That is the way that God has designed reality, that we might participate in what He is doing as He calls out a people to Himself, whom He is saving for all of eternity. So we should never stop working on being able to say the gospel as clearly as possible, even though God's the only one who can make someone respond to it. At the same time, our primary responsibility is to know the gospel. You can't say it clearly, or even half clearly, if you don't know it. And so an even more fundamental responsibility that we have is to be students of the Scriptures, that we might understand who God is and appreciate Him for ourselves, be thankful ourselves for His wonderful and majestic grace that has reached into our hearts and changed us into people who embrace the truth that Jesus is our Messiah, died for you and me as an offering that we might obtain the mercy and forgiveness of God. So be students, be teachers, and trust that God will fulfill His eternal purposes, and you and I will greet each other in heaven along with all the rest of the elect, the chosen, whom God will have called out down through history and brought to Himself to love forever and ever. Amen. Have a great week.